Hello and welcome to Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? I'm Annie.
And I'm Dave. Each month we take it in turns to nominate a film, a TV show, a book we were a fan of before we were married and the other one doesn't really know.
Then we both watch or read it and come together to discuss our reactions. Fair warning, there will be spoilers.
So today we're doing the 1987 film A Hazard of Huts,
based on
the Barbara Cartland novel of the same name. I would not have thought of you as being a Barbara Cartland girl.
Well, I don't know if I can say whether or not I've read any of them.
Okay.
But when I was a young teenager, we had two films.
VHS,
yes, in our VHS collection that were Barbara Cartland adaptations. This one and one called A Ghost in Monte Carlo, which does share some of the same cast.
Okay.
And is equal.
Okay.
In some ways I prefer it, but I thought this one was going to be better to discuss. But before we get into that, I would like to say that in certain values of our data, it's episode 100.
Woo! We've been doing this for a long time.
It's not episode 100 of the main podcast, because I've been doing reviews revisited on and off.
Yes.
So of the main podcast, it's only 72. But in terms of the actual naming of the file, okay, when I download the audio, it will be episode 100.
Fantastic.
On the website. So that's quite exciting.
So a thing that we started following the advice that you shouldn't make a podcast with your husband, Dave, just because you think you're funny.
Yeah.
We have ignored this advice.
We've done pretty well, I think.
Okay, yes.
Yeah.
Hurrah.
Coming up on 6 years.
Amazing.
Yeah. Anyway, so there is a specific reason why I picked this film.
Oh.
Did it ring any bells of similarity of some aspects of something that we watched together recently?
Sanderton?
Well, sort of. I mean, yes, because the TV adaptation of Sanderton is absolute nonsense and not very Austen-esque at all.
I mean, when you say that, it itself is not nonsense. I quite like it, but...
Oh, yeah. I love it.
It's not very close to the thing.
The source material. No, not that there's much of the source material. But anyway, no, linked to that, we watched something else Austen-related before we started watching Sanderton.
I remember that we did, but I can't remember what it was.
It was a film version of Northanger Abbey.
Oh, yeah.
And it had these little snippets of bodice ripper that Catherine was thinking about or reading about or dreaming about. And I thought it immediately made me think of this.
Okay. Well, it fits in with, I mean, you know, last year I read Vanity Fair after recommendation, which I really enjoyed. I'm reading some Trollope at the moment, which I'm also really enjoying. And although it is a slightly different time period, that kind of historical romance is something that I seem to have been, or at least historical books, I seem to have been reading quite a lot of recently. So
yeah,
it all kind of fits
in. I mean, obviously this has a slightly different tune.
Yes.
Slightly.
But it is, you know, very kind of Bridgerton-y, or at least what I imagine Bridgerton is like, having never watched it.
Oh, probably. No, I've never watched it either. So what were your thoughts overall?
Well,
dare I ask?
Much as I may regret saying this, my major takeaway is that it was too short.
Yeah, yeah, I remember you saying that, because I came home earlier than I expected and discovered you watching the movie. That didn't go where the listeners might have thought, but anyway. And so I took myself off into the spare room while you continued, so I wasn't sort of watching parts of it. And the journey that you went on, based on the audible reactions to various parts of the film, was quite epic.
There was quite a lot of laughing. There was quite a lot of, oh my God,
yes,
going on. So, but I was, you know, bought into everything that was going on.
Yeah.
My as I say, my major takeaway is that these days, if you're going to do it, you'd have to do it as a miniseries.
Yeah.
In particular, there is one character who is a highwayman, played by Gareth Hunt.
Okay.
From the New Avengers and, you know, all sorts of other things of the sort of 60s and 70s period, who's only in like one and a half scenes. And I'm fairly sure that he's must be a major character in, or, you know, a much more substantial character in the book, because he's really interesting.
He is really interesting.
And in the film, he gets like 20 lines and then he's done.
The last 20 minutes or so is very rushed.
We'll come to the last 20 minutes. But yeah, I mean, it was obviously massively over the top, ridiculousness on all fronts, which in some ways, you know, I quite like. But also, they squeezed a lot in, so I think a longer version would have been better if it had been an option. And what about you? How did it hold up for you overall?
Oh, I thought it was terrible.
Oh.
But I still loved it.
Oh, good. I was going to say, you're not going to be in a position where I liked it and you didn't. That would be
terrible. Oh, no, but it is terrible. I mean, in a lot of ways, it is terrible. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. I remembered it in a lot of detail. I mean, I haven't watched this in decades, but I think I must have nearly worn out that VHS tape, because the amount of detail that I remembered was quite impressive, shall we say. How about a brief plot synopsis for probably all of our viewers who will have never seen it?
Okay. So our heroine, Serena, lives with her father roughly around the 1780s. And is a, what I would call, for this kind of a genre, a kind of standard upper-class girl. She lives in a giant house, she has servants and clothes and jewellery and stuff. And as seems to happen a lot in the books that I've been reading recently, has this weird thing set up with her family where she doesn't have any money until she gets married, at which point she inherits a vast amount of cash from somewhere, which is very odd, because as I was saying to you the other day, you could end up in this situation where if she doesn't get married, she ends up, you know, being a pauper and then just has to marry somebody at random in order to get her cash. It's a very odd situation, but anyway.
But it also does protect her inheritance from the gambling habit of her father.
So her father gambles away all of their money and the house they live in, and also her hand in marriage, which says to me, sad to be alone in the world. It's all, I'm not sure you can do white slavery in the UK in the 1780s and literally gamble your daughter away.
The good old guys who are standing in the background are kind of like, oh, this is very exciting. And then when it happens, one of them leans over to the other and says, oh, that really shouldn't have been allowed. I'm like, you're standing right there, dude.
Yep. Anyway, so having lost his money, his house, and his daughter
to the nefarious Lord Rutum.
I'm going to get Lord Rutum and Lord Vulcan mixed up all the way through, because the surnames are so awesome.
Okay.
He shoots himself.
Yeah.
So then Serena finds that she has to go and live with her new fiancé, who she doesn't really know anything about, at his giant house. With
Mandrake House.
With his mother. And shenanigans ensue.
Yes. Shenanigans do, in fact, ensue. There are smugglers, there are highwaymen, there are abductions, there are jewels. There are jewels as well.
With a D.
Mm.
Yes.
Jewels with a J and jewels with a D.
Yeah.
Very exciting. There are secret passages and rooms where
giving all the stuff away.
Hidden away for years and years. There's betrayal, there's besmirching of family honour. I mean, it's all in there. As in fact, Barbara Cartland herself said.
Oh, you have a quote.
I do. She said in 1949, that was when the book came out.
Indeed.
This was my first costume drama, so I put in everything. Highwaymen, jewels, the kitchen stove.
Indeed. Should we do some facts?
Sure. That was all I got.
Okay, so this is made in 1987.
Yep.
It's made
When I was 10. But I don't think I started watching it until I was like 12, 13.
It was made directly for television by CBS in the States. Now, there's two things that immediately come from that. One of which is that it's got a weird aspect ratio. So it's not filmed in like a standard letterbox format. It's square.
Everything in the 80s on the TV was square.
Yeah. because that was presumably the type
the shape of the TV the screen.
Shapes of the TV screen, and yes. This is how they shot things. So it looks a bit weird. And second of all, in terms of, we might do some stuff about visual style in a bit, but the other thing is that it's, we watched it on a paid-for streaming service, but it's very obviously directly scanned off the VHS.
Yeah.
Which means that there's bits of it that are kind of wobbly and not in a cheap Doctor Who sets kind of, you know, wobbly, but it, as in, you know, the whole screen flickers a bit while you're watching it because they've scanned it off VHS.
Oh, the
80s. Which I just find really interesting that they couldn't find, well, I was going to say they couldn't find an original print, but the point was there wasn't any original print because it was shot for television.
Yeah.
So it would always been on some version of VHS. Yes, as you said, it was based on a 1949 novel by Barbara Cartland. Barbara Cartland lived from 1901 to 2000.
Wow.
She was 99 when she died.
And she wrote about 600 books.
So she was, or is, the third best non-religious selling author ever in any language.
Wow. Well, she did write about 600 books. Do you have actual numbers? Because I'm just making that up.
723.
Wow, I thought I was over-exaggerating, but apparently not. I know there were a lot of them.
Doesn't that come to like one every two or three months for like most of her entire life?
I mean, they were pretty much all the same, and they were pretty short. They were very short.
Yeah.
They were very pink.
Mm. But third best-selling non-religious author ever, only beaten by Shakespeare and Agatha Christie.
Wow. Amazing. Well, there you go.
She sold at least, probably more, but at least 500 million copies of her books.
I can see it. I mean, they were very popular.
She is the fifth most translated author of any kind ever.
Okay.
It's just mind-blowing. She was directly involved in the production of this film after previous adaptations had disappointed her, so she was on set telling them what to do.
Okay, I can see that.
Yeah.
She was quite a formidable woman, all told.
I don't really know anything about her life, to be honest, but she certainly looks that way from when you see her being interviewed. Can we briefly talk about the people in the film?
Oh, indeed. I mean, I remembered Helena Bonham Carter.
So Helena Bonham Carter looks about 14. I don't know. I didn't look up how old she was.
I presume would say a bit older than
I
that,
presume she's about 20.
Probably. But it was one of her earliest roles.
She looks very young in this.
Yeah. Well, she's meant to be.
And I made a note very early when I was watching the film, about 10 minutes in, that her acting was terrible.
Oh, God. Yes. Absolutely
and
horrifying.
Then I found, now it's weird because films have always shot out of order because they're shot in whatever's the most efficient and convenient way to shoot it, not, you know,
from
start to end. But I thought, I don't know whether I just got used to it, but it felt like her acting got progressively better the further down the film went.
But yeah, that's one of the main reasons why I prefer A Ghost in Monte Carlo, because I believe the heroine in that is played by Lizette Anthony.
I don't know who that is.
Okay, and I find her much more attractive. And also, there's something really off-putting about Helena Bonham Carter's eyebrows in this film.
There is a little bit of eyebrow acting from quite a lot of the characters in this.
But so I've never been as keen on this one. But I really liked her as a character more than I remembered.
Oh, her character's great. We'll definitely get into that.
So I also remembered Christopher Plummer.
So Christopher Plummer, I can't remember who
plays
he played.
Her dad. So he's not in it very much.
So he's hired. They say, we'd like you to come and do a very important role in this film. You'll get paid this amount of money. It's one day shoot.
Yeah, because he's only in one scene.
You essentially go into the gambling thing, do that, and then you go outside and shoot yourself. And that's it. So he's only in for one day.
And
he doesn't
get much more of a look in A Ghost of Monte Carlo because he plays the dad in that as well.
Oh.
And he is the target of the evil woman's nefarious schemes for reasons that end up being a mistake. So he gets horribly traumatized by her revenge scheme. But he is at least in it all the way through. He doesn't die in the first scene in the whole one.
Okay.
And I'd also remembered Edward Fox, who is, for a clean-shaven man, the most mustache-twirling of mustache-twirling villains.
Lord Rutan?
Yes.
Right. He is best known for being the lead in a film that I don't think I've ever seen.
Which is?
Day of the Jackal.
I don't think I've seen it either.
But it's a, what's the word I'm after? Very, very straight, very serious political thriller that was extremely popular when it came out. And that is extraordinarily different from this.
Where he is having the time of his life, chewing the scenery as much as physically possible. So I'd remembered all of them, but I had not in fact remembered.
Can we do other people before we do the big reveal?
Oh.
So we've got Marcus Gilbert, who is
oh my God. He was like the obsession of my young teenage heart. Oh. He is also the hero in Ghost of Monte Carlo.
He is best known otherwise for being Biggles.
Really?
In Biggles.
Wow.
Have you seen Biggles the film?
I must have done, but I don't remember him being in it. I remember him being in a couple of episodes of Sylvester McCoy era Doctor Who.
Oh, okay. I was about to suggest maybe doing Biggles in the future for the podcast, but the problem is that I conflate Biggles, which I believe is terrible, with The Rocketeer, which is filmed in a very similar style, but is actually really good.
I'm sure I must have seen the Biggles film, because I love Marcus Gilbert, and my mum absolutely loved Biggles, the Biggles books. We had all the Biggles books when I was growing up, so I've read them all.
It's a terrible sidetrack for a second, but Captain W.E. Johns, who wrote all the Biggles books, also wrote an excellent science fiction series, which is one of the things that got me into science fiction when I was like 10.
Yeah, well, there you go.
Really good.
But yes, Marcus Gilbert. I mean, the eyes, the cheekbones, the hair, the bearing, the trousers.
The trousers?
Oh.
I'm afraid I didn't pay any attention to the trousers. I mean,
the horse riding. I mean, wow.
There's a lot of very good horse riding. We'll come to that in a bit.
Can't beat it.
Two more people. We've got Stuart Granger, who is a relatively famous actor, and Fiona Fullerton, who is a relatively famous actress. It does feel like some of the people in this are slumming it a little.
Well, I mean, what on earth? What on earth is Diana Rigg doing in this?
Oh my God, she's so good in this.
What is she doing?
She's being awesome.
Well, true, but I had not remembered that she was in it at all.
But
I hadn't actually remembered her character at all, which is weird.
Oh, she's the best thing in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's by far the best thing in it.
Yeah, so that was a surprise.
So Diana Rigg is amazing. Diana Rigg, best known from being in The Avengers.
Yes, which is long before this.
The original black and white. I can't remember the guy's name, the actor's name, but you know, John Steed, the British science fiction fantasy spies kind of show. And then that was rebooted some decades later in a thing called The New Avengers, which is where Gareth Hunt, who plays Joker, the Highwoman, starred in the new version.
Oh, interesting.
So that's his link to Diana Rigg.
Okay. But yeah, she started out in sexy outfits in The Avengers and ended up with epic political intrigue in Game of Thrones and did this in between.
Oh, good grief. It hadn't clocked me at all that she was that person from Game of Thrones. Yeah. Oh, she's so amazing in that.
Yes.
She's also the best thing in that.
Yes, wow. Absolutely. So,
I hadn't realised that was her at all.
And I saw her on stage as Medea.
I have no idea what that is.
It's something a Greek tragedy. Greek. And it's it's one of the stage performances that absolutely has stayed very firmly in my head because it was quite shockingly graphic.
If one
in
dies
its
at the end.
Depiction of her murdering her children.
Okay.
So, but yeah, she was absolutely phenomenal. Anyway, so yes, Diana Rigg, here for it.
Absolutely. Okay. Three more very quick things under facts. Mm-hmm. Wikipedia has nothing.
No.
It doesn't say any.
Sank without trace.
It doesn't say how much it cost to make or how much money it made. Well, it wouldn't do because it was shown on TV, so it doesn't have any presumably public money. Nothing about critical reception on Wikipedia. Rotten Tomatoes has a rating of 61% and Metacritic doesn't have an entry.
Wow. Well, yes, fair
so
enough.
So it has bit dropped off the world.
It is quite, despite the cast. It is, I would imagine, a fairly obscure film that somehow got into our VHS collection and I got completely obsessed with it.
So, In terms of other stuff,
before
we get into like general bits and pieces, I have some specific things.
Oh, I was going to say the person, the really unexpected person who's in A Ghost in Monte Carlo that I'd forgotten. Joanna Lumley.
Really?
Yes.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing.
So there you go. Barbara Cartland obviously had some casting clout in the late 80s.
I mean, if we're going another 6 years, perhaps you can do The Ghost in Monte Carlo, because I've not seen it. See if you can find it.
I mean, in some ways it's better, but the bad guy in that is Oliver Reed, and he's just so grim.
Yeah.
So grim.
Yeah.
So,
that's a shame. So, as I say, I've got some specific things to talk about. I've got some character things to talk about. I've got some general stuff to talk about. But I've got a little bit at the top that just says meta. And the thing at the top of that, it says in bold, all caps with an exclamation mark, it just says, pathos!
Okay, do explain.
It's so dramatic.
It's melodrama.
It's just maximum drama all of the time.
It's absolute bodice-ripping melodrama.
Every character needs to have two people in livery follow them around with a fainting couch at all times.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it opens with Serena.
Oh God, the line
on her horse.
The first line.
Cantering.
Are you going to do it, or shall I do it?
The greensward.
Yes.
And then it cuts to Edward Fox as Evil Lord Rootham up in the trees with a random guy.
Yeah.
And he says,
"I shall have her."
Yes, and that's oh God, how we start.
Amazing.
And that's how we start, sets the tone right from the beginning.
A couple of quick bits about how it looks and how it sounds.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really freaked out in the opening credits, because the opening credits have what are paintings or sketches of the characters next to like the actors' names that you see at the start of the thing.
Mm-hmm. That's fairly standard.
And they're all static, apart from, I think it's Helena Bonham Carter's one, which turns around and looks at you in the middle of while you're watching it, and you're like, "Wah!"
I wasn't paying attention, missed that. Yep.
So that was really creepy. I think that one of the really interesting things about the visual style, and to probably some extent as well, the style of music and stuff, is how much it owes to Hammer Horror.
Oh, really?
Yeah, the way it's directed and the way it's lit, the way it's shot, so much of that is like classic Hammer Horror.
Yeah,
it's really interesting the way that they've put that together.
Okay, if you say so.
So I thought that was very interesting. A quick aside, I know this is stupid, but they make, as often happens in, it happens less and less these days, but happened a lot in the past, where you've got characters wandering around holding candles, or they're sitting in a room where there's just like two or three candles on the wall, and there's massive amounts of ambient light.
Yes. Oh yeah. Yeah.
In every room, coming from behind the camera.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Just like, okay, this looks very weird. But of course, we've swept all the way the other way now, because these days, unless you have some kind of special TV,
you can't see anything.
Dark on dark. Ridiculous. You can't actually see anything at all. In terms of the musical style, I thought it was interesting again that it massively amps up the melodrama.
Oh yeah, there's lots of sweeping strings and.
But the other thing with it is that it can be, music should be, in this type of thing anyway, should be something that's important to carry you along but that you don't really notice. And there are a number of times when it did really notice for me, because they have themes for different people and they're really unsubtle about how, when it cuts from like one person to another person, even if they're like in the same room looking at each other, you might get this sudden snap cut between their music themes.
Right, yeah.
And you suddenly go, "Wow, what the hell just happened there?" So that was a bit of a thing. Yeah, before I start doing my normal thing of just going on and on, what would you like to talk about?
So I have a question, but I will have to preface it with a slight explanation. So we've got Lord Rootham, who is completely obsessed with Serena, and absolutely desperate to get her at any cost.
Carry her away
at any cost. And so he inveigles Serena's dad into well, he baits Serena's dad into to betting the farm, literally.
Yes.
And it's ridiculous because there's this whole thing about people's luck in the film. Because they're just rolling dice. There's no skill involved in this at all. Go on.
So I... For listeners, I was sitting there with my hand up. So can I talk briefly just about gambling since you brought it up?
Sure.
So gambling is a trope that comes up a lot in historical novels. So I'm reading Can You Forgive Her, which is the first of the Palliser series by Anthony Trollope at the moment, and gambling is a major running theme in that. I wonder partly because, you know, if you don't have anything but novels to read, because, you know, TV and films and media haven't been invented yet, that, you know, what do you go and do? You stare at scenery, you read a novel, or you go and gamble. But also because it's a really slightly lazy way for characters to end up in trouble and have to borrow money from people. And,
but it's usually cards. I don't think I've really seen it be dice before.
So one of the notes that I wrote down was what you were saying about the dice. And I'll let you. I will be very interested in what you have to say about that in a minute. But the other thing, since we're talking about gambling, before we go back to that, is simply what would have happened if at the end of the thing where he'd lost, you know, lost his house, his daughter and stuff, if he just said, nah, I'm just not going to do that. Because there's no contract.
Yes, true.
So he could have walked away from the table, and all that would have happened is he would have lost his, you know, his honour, and he would have lost his associations with the men of stature that were in the room, and, you know, he'd have gone back to his house and his money and his daughter and his, you know, vast tracts of land, and it all been fine, but he would have been shunned and ruined in society.
But he still would have
had... But he still would have had all the things, all the stuff, because there was no contract. So what this film says is that he would literally rather prostitute his daughter and commit suicide rather than be shunned by society.
Yes. Well, he's also a gambling addict.
Well, yes. But my point is that the fear in upper class society of the period of being ostracized was so totally overriding that you would literally sell your daughter and kill yourself. Rather than, you know, be seen as being a bad person.
And as you say about the lack of contract, with the when the two guys who are commentating the scene and introducing the audience to who all of the different people are, I'll come back to, say, oh, that should never have been allowed.
Mm-hmm.
By whom?
Yes.
Because nobody is regulating
the
activities in this gentleman's club.
Yeah.
Anyway, what I was going to say was that Rutum baits Serena's dad into continuing to gamble and then making the stakes higher and higher and higher. And because obviously, you know, it's rigged not in the film, but in the shooting of the film. Yes. Every single time they do a roll, Rutum always gets one higher.
Yes.
Every time, which is totally ridiculous.
Yes.
And also the fact that, you know, he is so confident. It's dice. He can't be confident about dice.
Well, you can, but you just look stupid if you get it wrong.
Yeah.
The thing that gets me is that nobody accuses anybody else of cheating. As you say...
Well, they're using the same dice.
He gets one higher all the time. And, well, yes, but there's ways to palm dice.
True.
And change with other things. But the way the dice work in the film is so ridiculous. Somebody sooner or later has to say, come on, that can't
be a real thing. Obviously that doesn't happen. So then once Rutum has won the money, the house, Serena's hand in marriage, the dad staggers out of the room.
Yes.
And before you get the gunshot, Lord Vulcan, who has made a very impressive entrance earlier on and gone to stand and lean nonchalantly against the mantelpiece in his trousers. Yes.
So this is Biggles. He is...
Marcus Gilbert.
25...
ish, yeah.
Handsome.
Very handsome. Very kind of aloof.
Obviously the male lead.
Yeah.
Yeah. So just helping myself and the listeners keep track that Lord Rutan is the older I must have her guy.
Bad guy. Yeah.
And Lord Vulcan is the
incredibly attractive, young,
emotionally repressed,
yeah,
highly damaged.
Yeah, well, I want to come back to that. But in order to get to where I was going.
Sorry.
No, it's not you. I'm interrupting myself. He steps in and he says, I will wager you 100,000 guineas against the lot.
I forgot about
the house and the girl.
Mm-hmm.
And as though he's got 100,000 guineas in a bag in his pocket, he pulls a bag out of his pocket and puts it on the table. And I'm like, no. But anyway.
There's a whole bunch of stuff in Trollope where somebody will come up to somebody else and say, can I borrow £1,000? And I don't know what Trollope's like, 1840s, I think, something like that. And people will say, oh yes, I have that with me. I will just ask my servant to go and take the money out of the box and give it to you. Because they're just carrying thousands and thousands of pounds around in cash.
So he says on the one roll, so then of course Rutum rolls an 11.
Yes.
And then of course Lord Vulcan rolls a double 6.
Yes.
And wins all the stuff. Mm-hmm. And that's when you get the shot. So you don't know that what was probably going to happen was that he was going to go and find the dad and go, it's fine, I've sorted it all out, have everything back.
Oh, possibly.
Because despite the fact that he is presented as even worse than Lord Rutum when Serena is told about this, that's what Cousin Nicholas says, that Lord Vulcan is even worse.
Mm.
He's actually incredibly sweet and adorable all the way through.
He is, yes.
But what the amazing commentator guys say is...
Who are never named and never in it again.
No, one of them's Gillingham.
Who's that?
Isabel's brother, the blonde one.
Oh, the horror at the end.
Yes.
Okay, yes.
he says, there's something inhuman about Vulcan. He never shows any emotion. And my question is that a Star Trek reference? Not in 1949.
No.
But in 1987.
I mean, possibly.
Or is the Star Trek naming of the thing a reference to the Barbara Carlin novel?
Oh, I see. Oh, I hadn't thought of that. Oh.
I only just thought of that now. It seems very unlikely.
I mean, it's certainly amusing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the kind of thing that the writers might have picked up subliminally. It's difficult to tell.
But it's an interesting coincidence.
It is.
It's not deliberate.
It is a trope, though. Can I pick up another trope?
Of course.
Somebody says, I'm afraid I didn't write down who it was, he's never shown any emotion to any of the women that he's been with, which tells us two things. First of all, he's been with several women.
Oh, yeah. So Cousin Nicholas says that Lord Vulcan is worse because he's heartless to the women who love him, and there have been many.
Oh. And...
We do find out why, but anyway.
And she... possibly also says he became like a locked door after...
No, that's his dad that says that.
Is it?
Yes.
Oh, okay. After what happened?
While he was away on his grand tour, his parents pretended that his dad had died.
Oh, this is another one of those weird inheritance things.
Yes, so that the estate could be saved.
Where his father has no money.
But he will more money will be released once he takes over the title. So they pretend he's died.
So the father's died.
And when Justin, Lord Vulcan, comes back from his travels and finds out that it's not true, he feels as though they have besmirched the family honour. And he also feels that he can't get married because he would be living a lie because he's an imposter.
It's also this... I said this earlier. There's this ridiculous idea that... while his father is still alive, they could lose everything and be literally kicked out into the street and go into debtor's prison. And then as soon as his father dies, he has enough money to, you know, buy a giant house in the country.
Yeah.
This makes no sense.
No,
it's
I agree.
It's so insane.
Yes, going back to the commentator people, it is a demonstration of the terrible exposition dialogue. Because when he arrives... one of them leans over and whispers to the other, Lord Vulcan is here. Justin Vulcan.
Yes.
And then later on, Serena says when Nicholas suggests that he marry her to
this is her
save
child,
her.
This is her childhood friend.
Her cousin. Yeah.
It's another one of those.
Cousin Nicholas. Yes, he says that they can get married.
All the people in Trollope that are getting married are all cousins.
Yeah.
It's
to save her from Lord Vulcan.
Yeah.
And she says... I know you're head over heels about Lord Norton's young widow, Isabel Gillingham.
Yes.
And then later, when Vulcan is talking to Isabel, he says, if your brother here, my dear Lord Gillingham, hadn't mentioned it, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, oh my God, how clunky can you get with the dialogue and people explaining who people are to people who are actually related to them?
Mm-hmm.
So that was a bit iffy. But anyway.
I didn't quite finish the he has no emotion trope thing.
Oh, sorry.
Sorry, we're cutting about a little bit. Because it's related to the he may be cold and heartless, but I can fix him.
Yes. Yes.
Which,
but the thing,
you know,
is,
we
as
see
I say,
in so many...
That isn't the thing in this, though. She doesn't... I mean, because he's really sweet and lovely all the way through to her.
I mean...
He really is.
I mean, to a greater or lesser extent, I would say that there's a bit near the end which makes me go... But apart,
yes,
there
is one bit in particular. But
apart from that, he's generally really, really nice.
Yeah, he's nice to everybody, apart from his mother. And
Stepmother.
Is it?
Yeah.
No, it's not. It's definitely his mother.
Diana Rigg's not his mother.
Yeah. She is. No, she absolutely is.
I think his mother died and his father married a younger woman.
No, she's definitely his mother.
Really?
Absolutely. Otherwise he would have kicked her out.
He wouldn't be able.
She constantly refers to him as her son.
Yes, but I thought that was the way that you just did.
No. When... Definitely not.
Okay.
She says, he will never marry. I am his life.
Oh, there is. Oh, mothers and sons. I've got that written down somewhere.
So it's definitely not a stepmother thing.
There's definitely... There's this whole weird, creepy thing about mothers and sons.
Yeah, it's horrifying.
Which, in period books, but also, I've been watching some skit comedy on YouTube. And there are people who do parodies of tropes in modern things, especially like anime. And one of those things is, again, mothers and sons. And, you know, I am the most important person in his life and he will never leave me and he could never possibly, you know, nobody will ever be good enough. And
blah, blah, blah. She's definitely,
so it's
definitely his mother.
But it's, you know, it's still a trope that's around, like, you know, hundreds of years later. It's still in the present day.
Yeah.
Cool. What else have we got?
What else have I got?
Shall I pick some things?
Yes, do it.
So there are some lovely horses.
There are some lovely horses.
There are some really nice dogs.
Yes, yes. Serena has an amazing... Is he a Great Dane?
I don't know.
His name is Warrior. I did find it a bit weird, though, that when she takes him out for a walk, she doesn't have a lead, so she's just holding on to his collar, which just seemed a bit harsh.
That is a bit weird. And there are some great houses. I don't know where it's shot.
Yeah.
But, you know, some of these places... I mean, dear God, I wouldn't want to live there. But they're,
it's a bit weird it being called Mandrake. It's a bit of a weird name for a house.
Epictor. Yeah. Yes, indeed.
Plant that looks like a dead body.
Yes. But, you know, epic places to wander around in a kind of National Trust kind of way.
Yeah.
Other things that I've written down in no particular order. She doesn't seem to have any other friends or relatives. This is a very common thing.
Yeah, she's got one maid, Eudora.
That when, you know, she's carted off to go and live with this person that she's essentially been sold to.
Yeah.
There's a bit that she says, I must honour my father's debt. And I'm like,
why?
There's absolutely no reason why you should do that.
Yes.
I mean, yes, you don't have any money, but, you know...
Well, you do as soon as you get married.
But also...
80,000 guineas.
But also, your cousin has money. He could stick you in a flat somewhere, but she's no friends she can go and stay with. She's got no other, but she's got no older relatives that are coming in and going, what the hell is this? I'm not letting this happen.
She's refreshingly self-possessed, though.
Oh, she's got a very strong character.
Yeah, she speaks her mind.
Her character is great.
She does talk about being frightened of Lady Vulcan, but she doesn't demonstrate that at any point.
Yeah.
She stands up for herself. You know, she doesn't beat about the bush.
So
She does need some help at various points, but she's never helpless.
Mm-hmm.
She very much contributes to saving herself on multiple occasions, which is amazing. She does faint a couple of times, but you know, I think under the circumstances, understandable.
So I'll jump to because I divide stuff up in odd ways when I take my notes. I've got a section that's just about Helena Bonham Carter.
Yeah.
So I've written never looked so young. In the first part, most of the acting is the eyebrows.
Yeah.
She turns up to go and see Lord Vulcan the first time that they interact in a room, and she seems to be wearing a floor-length white brackets virginal nightdress.
Well, it is the middle of the night.
Oh, was it?
Yes.
So they've literally got her up.
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
Yes.
Okay. The first time that she sees Lord Vulcan, she tells him to his face that she knows the name of his current lover.
Yeah.
That was,
I know,
really funny. I know that you're involved with the famous actress What's Her Chops.
Yeah.
And he's like, well, crap. What else have I got? Do you think that the character, her character, is kind of self-insert wish fulfillment for the kind of young woman that would read the book,
because
gets to have the house and the clothes and, you know, the dashing and charming gentleman who she fixes, but also is basically in the face of everybody all the way through.
Yeah, pretty much.
She's so brazen in her attitude, which is so great, partially for, you know, the period novel, because the female characters in the book that I'm reading at the moment, the Trollop, are so pathetic. It's really annoying. But also even for 1949, when the book was written.
Yeah.
You know, she is, as you say, very feisty. It's great. So, yeah. Do you want to, since we're talking about her jump near the end, we are going to jump out a little bit, to talk about the manic ride to London.
So there's, before then, there's the abduction when Rutum turns up and carries her off and starts ravishing her in the carriage and saying that he's going to force her to marry him. And she is very fortunate in that the highwoman stops the coach and is robbing Rutum. But she then stands there and goes, ah, you are, look like a fine upstanding gentleman compared to this
is to the
horrible guy that I'm standing next to.
Yes.
Could you possibly give me a lift back to the Vulcan estate?
Yes.
And it turns out that he is, in fact, extremely nice and does the thing. But, you know, it's very, you know, prepossessing that she's like,
I am
going to save myself here by throwing myself on the mercy of the highwayman. And then right at the end, when Rutum, again, has her at his mercy after the sword fight with Vulcan, and Rutum is holding a knife to her throat, so Justin drops his sword, and then she whacks Rutum round the chops with a giant piece of rope and runs away. So she's like rescues herself again.
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
So
she's never completely at a loss.
Yeah.
And she runs everywhere.
Yeah.
Even when she's just
in,
you know,
those skirts.
In the house.
In those shoes.
You know, she runs to dinner and she runs from dinner. And it turns out to be in good, to put her in good stead, because then she has to do quite a lot of running away later on in the film. But she just runs everywhere, which seems very odd for a young lady at the time.
Since I mentioned the horse thing anyway, should we quickly do that now?
Yeah, that was a bit kind of ridiculous. So after she tells Justin that Rutum abducted and attempted to rape her, he challenges Rutum to a duel. And Rutum cheats and turns round and fires his gun before time. And so Justin then falls to the ground, and one of the servants who's there, immediately gets on his horse and gallops back to the house and says, oh my God, to the mother and Serena, this is a terrible thing has happened, and Lord Vulcan's been shot. And so Serena takes the horse, his horse, from the stables, the stallion that only Lord Vulcan can ride, Thunderbolt, and gallops her way to London to
reach his side. Because he is, I mean, I know nothing about horses, but he is a very, very...
He is a very, very nice
very
horse.
Pretty horse.
Yeah, black stallion.
Wow.
Very impressive. And so she makes this dramatic ride to London, and then it turns out that he's just been grazed by the bullet and he's absolutely fine, and she walks into the drawing room covered in mud to find him laughing with his friends and the actress who he's been linked to, and so she falls down in a dead faint at his feet, which is a bit disappointing.
But I didn't think it was really amusing that she, you know, does this epic ride on this unrideable horse, and then they actually have her turn up really sweaty and manky when she turns up into the room.
Covered in mud.
I thought that was great.
Yes, mud smeared all over her face.
Okay, so we've jumped around quite a lot. So it's going to be quite difficult, I think, for the listeners to work out what happens in what order. So I apologise for jumping around. So at some point in time during the period after Serena's arrived at this house, so Lord Vulcan is potentially around about doing stuff and not really wanting to, you know, be around her. They never, I think, in the entire film ever refer to each other as, like, fiancé or anything.
No.
They have, you know, some witty banter to some extent.
Well, he doesn't actually want to marry her. Because
he
doesn't think that he can marry anyone.
Mm-hmm.
And he has no interest in her. He was just trying to save her from Rutan.
So they have a bit of witty banter, but they don't interact all that much.
And as I say, I'm pretty sure he was just going to go to the dad and go, I absolve you of all the debt. I've just saved you.
Yeah.
And then because the dad kills himself, he then finds himself responsible for everything.
She discovers, hidden behind the bookcase...
Oh, yes. A secret passage.
No, not the secret passage. The actual Lord Vulcan.
Oh, no, he's in the tower.
Is he?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
The secret passage is down into the caves where the smugglers are.
So it turns out... the real Lord Vulcan
is still alive.
Not really dead.
Yes, and he's adorable.
He is.
But much like
so
the High
lovely.
Woman, he's only actually in one scene.
Yeah.
And I really would have liked more of him.
This
because
is
he has to die at the end so that Justin can take the title and be legitimately Lord Vulcan, which
exactly.
is such a shame.
Yes.
Because he's really adorable.
He is really adorable. And this is why it has to be a miniseries, because there needs to be more of him as well as more of Joker the High Woman.
Yes.
But going back to what you were just saying, the other thing she... Well, first thing she discovers is that Diana Rigg's character, help me out.
Lady Vulcan.
Lady Vulcan is running an illegal gambling den and has all these people come in and do gambling, presumably for a cut. But because she is also a gambling addict herself, is in a massive amount of debt because she's been... losing at her own gambling establishment that she set up, which, you know, you wouldn't have thought would be possible, but this is a whole thing that she's done. I think it's either Helena Bonham Carter's maid or another one of the servants or something. Oh, it might even be, what's her name? Her cousin's...
Isabel.
Isabel, who says to her, "You have no idea what goes on at this house." And I was like, is it orgies?
Well, is
this what's going on? But... So she discovers the illegal gambling den, and then somehow, and this is the bit I forget, somebody tells her about the secret passage.
Yeah, no, she finds the secret passage because she sees Lady Vulcan going into it. But she doesn't get the opportunity to explore it until...
I missed
when
that, because my question was, how on earth did she find it? Because it's just like a random wood pallet in the middle of the corridor.
She sees Lady Vulcan going down there,
and
she's investigating, and Justin finds her and interrupts her. But then he knows that she knows where it is. So when the guards turn up to question people about the smuggling ring, he can tell her to go and let his mother know that the guards are there.
Right. So she goes down into the secret passage, and in the secret passage it has one of these things where there are burning torches on the walls, which are presumably somehow magically burning all the time.
Wow.
Which is a thing. And it turns out that there is a passageway down from this house, which when you look at it from the outside is in the middle of this, you know, big green parkland. And do we see that?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. But then it goes down through
the underground caverns.
Through the cliffs to where the smuggling is happening, which is where Lady Vulcan is trying to make enough money from bringing things legally over from France to cover her gambling debts, which she's lost at her own gambling thing. Now, Lady Vulcan has what might be described as a somewhat disagreement with the people who are doing the smuggling, which ends with...
her stabbing one of them with her sword stick.
The murdering! It's the other thing that I've got...
The murdering.
...in bold, in all capitals with an exclamation mark in my notes, is just... Is there any secret that can be kept from you in this house? Dinah Rigg at one point says to Helena Bonham Carter, to which she should have responded, well, I haven't told anybody about the murdering. It's been several days.
Yeah.
And I haven't reported you to the police for, you know, the murdering.
Yeah.
It's just never referred to again.
That's very true.
It's just, oh,
well,
dear.
You know, he's a smuggler, so he's not a real person.
Uh-huh. Okay. Yeah, what else have you got?
Should we talk about Justin?
Lord Vulcan.
Yes.
He's very sweet.
He is very sweet. He has a couple of moments, though, because there are problematical aspects of the romance in this film. So Isabel is absolutely besotted and he doesn't even give her the time of day. And she took me by surprise because she's originally presented as like the traditional sort of catty, jealous bitch character.
Is it, sorry, who?
Isabel, the blonde one.
Yes. I'm not entirely sure why she's even at the house.
Well, she's just there for dinner.
Okay. She's just somebody.
She's just his friend's sister. But anyway.
Okay, sorry.
And... but she actually, when she sits down to have a chat with Serena, Serena's very open and honest with her about the situation and says that she doesn't actually have any interest in Justin at all. Mm-hmm. And Isabel's like, oh, actually, maybe we could be friends. And then starts opening up. And then she utters the words, the colder he is to me, the more he makes me suffer, the more I love him.
Yeah.
Which is not great.
It's very, very... trollop-esque from what I'm
reading. Oh yeah,
at the
absolutely. And it is quite traditional. And then, you know, Justin himself utters the phrase, shall I make you fall in love with me, Serena?
That's one of the things at the end that made me want to, you know, burn
which
everything.
I probably thought was wildly romantic when I was 13, and I am kind of ashamed to admit it. And then at the end, I can't even remember what he's trying to do, but he's trying to get her to come over to him, the other side of the room, to talk to him, and he says, come here, and she says no, and he says, you'll have to vow to obey me when we're married, so you might as well start now.
That is the main line takeaway from the film.
Ooh, which is, you know, he's kind of joking but not really.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not great. And then
there's a lot of stuff like that in the books that I've read about this period. Partly, you know, the women have to absolutely obey. Partly, you know, they are legally property. And partly that the second that they get married, they lose all of their money and property, which is immediately effectively signed over to their husband. And the only things that they're allowed to have are things that their husbands effectively give them or allow them to control. The
but
husband's
is...
like, I see you have 100,000 a year. Sign this piece of paper. Aha, now I have 100,000 a year.
Yeah. But it is traditionally a trope in romance that it's meant to be attractive when men are high-handed and controlling. And I definitely, you know, I mean, I've never fallen for it in real life, but I definitely have, you know, read those stories and found them compelling.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's...
when I was younger. I don't so much now.
Mm. Oh, it's definitely a thing.
But it gets worse because Cousin Nicholas is desperately in love with Isabel, and she, much like Justin, for her, never gives him the time of day.
Mm-hmm.
And Serena says that he needs to be more assertive with her.
Oh.
And then right at the end, he's trying to argue with her about something and goes, I beg of you, Isabel. And she says, oh, yes, beg. That's all you ever do. And then he just loses it and goes, shut up, shut up, shut up. You're just being, you know, absolutely ridiculous. And he grabs her, throws her down on a bench, flings himself on top of her, kisses her, and then storms off.
Yeah.
And her response is to sit up with this incredible expression on her face and go, oh, Nicholas! And it makes you want to burn everything.
It does indeed make you want to burn everything, I'm
afraid.
Comedy
sexual assault, which is, you know, not great.
We are indeed supposed to find it funny. So I've got a few...
You know, but it was the 80s, and that's what romance was in the 80s.
Well, it still is for a lot of people.
It is, yeah. There's still not a really terrible amount of surprise kissing and that kind of stuff going on in things even today. It has got better. I mean, there's an awful lot more stuff to do with consent in films and TV shows now than there was.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, every now and then there's surprise kissing and manhandling does still turn up.
Well, it happens in the real world a lot, so...
Yeah, and it's just interesting that there's that, and there's also when Rutum has her in the coach, when he's carrying her off, she says, "You make me shudder." And he goes, "How exciting, I long to make you shudder." And we're obviously meant to find that incredibly horrifying.
Yes.
And yet it's not actually all that different.
No. Can I do another two or three small bits?
Of course.
So we get near the end. So we've had the duel, and Lord Vulcan, the young one, has been shot and then recovered. He's gone back to his house, and then, for reasons that I forget, he ends up in the smuggler's tunnels. I think he's... So Lord Rutan, after him carrying off Serena, being interrupted by Joker the Highwayman, and then she going back to the house, does Lord Rutan follow them back to the house and then...
No, there's the whole duel in between, and then he's fled to France.
But
then he turns up again at the end.
So why is
having made a deal?
So why is she in the tunnel when he leaps out and?
Because she's running away from Lady Vulcan, who's made a deal with Lord Rutum to get paid for delivering Serena to her. But Serena's run away. And she runs down the secret passage.
And then he leaps out and grabs her. And
he also kills Lady Vulcan, which solves the problem of that.
But yes, she is killed off. If that is his mother, Lord Vulcan doesn't seem... the younger doesn't seem particularly fussed about this. But sword fight.
Yes.
So there's
it goes on too long.
So there's a sword fight between...
Justin and Lord Rutum.
Justin and Lord Rutum, which is characterised by two things. One of which is it's much too long.
Yes.
It's about twice the length it should be.
Yeah, agreed.
But the second thing is it's really good.
Yeah.
I don't know how much of that is the actual actors, and I don't know how much of that is cut away to stunt people, but it's a really... I mean, the actual... It's not the kind of thing you often see in films of, I'm going to swing overhead and parry, It's... actual sword fighting as you would actually do, and it was really, really well choreographed. Much too long. There's the ridiculous trope that Lord Vulcan knocks the sword out of the hand of Lord Rutan and then picks it up and gives it him back rather than just stabbing him at that point.
Yes.
Like, rrr. But anyway, yes, sword fight. After the sword fight, we come to the end. It's a romance film, so we're going to have a wedding.
Oh, before we get to the wedding,
sorry,
there's one thing that really made me cringe. There are two occasions when Justin and Serena have a moment of physical intimacy in the film before the very end.
Oh.
And on both occasions, he leans down and kisses her on the forehead. And it just made me want to vomit.
Why?
Because it's so condescending and it makes her look like a child.
But a lot of people do that. I mean, we do that sometimes.
No, but I don't know, in the context. Okay. And then I thought I was finally going to get the actual proper kiss at the end. And it freeze-framed just before the kiss properly happened.
Oh, the very, very
last. And
then
the end is superimposed over their faces, and I felt cheated.
Yeah. I remember you going, no, at the screen.
Yes.
Annoying. So the wedding... And I think Justin says, a decision in our affairs has been thrust upon us. Which is...
Yes, it's not the most wildly romantic
proposal
ever, is it?
So there's no real conversation about this. It's like, I guess we're getting married now.
Yeah.
And then she says, no.
Does she?
And it looks like he's going to explode. And then he says, it's okay, I'm no longer involved with... famous actress, what's the chops?
Haven't been since the first time I saw you.
And then she says, oh, well, if that's okay, then fair enough, let's get married.
Yeah,
and
much.
That was the weird thing
it
at
was,
the end.
Yeah, it wasn't the most romantic proposal scene ever. That's true. And that's when he says, you're going to have to swear to obey me when we marry. You might as well start now.
Oh, yes. Yes.
And then he kisses her on the forehead.
Yes. At which point I think I am done.
Yeah. We've pretty much talked about most of the diversity stuff because there's a quite a range of really interesting and very different women in this film.
Oh, yeah.
And most of them are pretty strong characters in one way or another.
I mean, there's Serena was a strong character. Her maid's a fairly strong character. Yeah. Diana Rigg is a strong character.
Isabel has her moments.
Isabel certainly has her moments. Yeah.
Yeah, so they're all pretty good. But then there's the rather sort of toxic romanticism of, you know, comedy sexual assault.
Yes.
Which is less than ideal.
And there's a whole weird power thing going on at the end.
And obviously it's 100% white.
Yes, yes, yes.
And there's no queer rep either.
Well, it wouldn't be either in
1949 or 1987. Well, I mean, maybe 1987.
I mean, there wouldn't be in 1949, but there wouldn't be in 1780 either.
No, true.
Even if people were, they wouldn't have referred to it. But yes, surprisingly enjoyable.
Oh, there we go.
I could have watched more. I apparently.
Well, maybe we should watch A Ghost in Monte Carlo.
We went to a reading retreat a year or two ago. And part of that is you get a reading prescription from the people who run it. And they send you like a questionnaire and you fill it in and give it to them. And the person in charge,
Cressy,
the top of the list for me to read was Vanity Fair, which I didn't necessarily think I was going to enjoy. And I loved
it. You loved that book. Oh my God.
It took me a very long time to read it because it's very thick, but it was really good. So it turns out that I like kind of Edwardian Victorian comedy, of which this fits in broadly. Well, comedy, melodrama.
Yes, melodrama. That's but better fit.
Period melodrama is apparently my bag. So
okay.
Who knew?
Okay, so that about wraps it up for this month's discussion. So it's time for the ratings. We use a standard 5-star rating system with half stars allowed. Dave, what is your rating for A Hazard of Heart?
I hadn't even thought up until this moment.
Snap decision?
4.
Whoa! Okay, amazing. Me too. Okay. I actually wrote down, do I dare? 4 stars, do I dare? Well, yes.
I mean, my thinking was whether I wanted to give it 4 or 4.5.
Wow, okay. I don't think I would go that far.
I think 4 is the right answer.
Wow. Fair enough.
So presumably you still love it?
I did still love it. It's true. Yes. So, in terms of next month, we have a special guest, our friend Nick from Choir, who has picked something that was on my list from the start, but that I don't think I was ever going to choose, but she has forced my hand.
So, we're doing Dirty Dancing.
Yeah.
Which I claim I've never seen.
I'm pretty sure you have.
But you think that I have watched it since we met, but yeah. I have... no recollection.
Oh, well, that's fine. I mean, I knew it was eligible, but I'm not sure I want to either revisit it or have you pull it to pieces. But Nick's going to be here, so I will have some moral support unless we both discover we hate it now too. So who knows?
Seems unlikely, but we'll see.
Yeah.
And that's it for this month's episode of Will You Still Love It Tomorrow? Many thanks to Cambo for our theme music, and thank you all for listening. If you like the show, please rate and review it wherever you get your podcasts.
And if you have any comments, or if you want to tell us about a time you shared some media you love and whether or not you still loved it afterwards, you can email us at willyoustilloveit@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you.
Remember, you can buy our merch at bit.ly/loveittomorrowpodcast with hyphens where the spaces would be.
And please join us next month to find out what Dave thinks of Dirty Dancing.
And whether or not Annie still loves it after our discussion.
Bye for now.
Bye.